Republicans to wake up. What the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
You have successfully downloaded the latest episode of the Peter B. Collins podcast. Congratulations. My thanks to people who helped support this show: Russ Archibald in Hawaii, David Mills, Joan Falber, and Bill Lackamacher in Sacramento. If you'd like to help and you're able, go to my website, peterbcollins.com. The links are on the right-hand side of the homepage, and our voluntary subscriptions start at just $5 a month. Here comes the next installment in the Boiling Frogs interview series, co-hosted with the very courageous Sabelle Edmonds. And today, a contributor to the Boiling Frogs Post, the guy who follows the money. Bill Bergman blew the whistle on activities at the Federal Reserve Bank in Chicago. And today he offers his analysis of some of the pre-9/11 money transactions, some of which have still not been explained. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sabelle Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. Our guest today is the Boiling Frog Post's own senior financial analyst, Bill Bergman, who joins us from Chicago. He has 10 years of experience as a stock market analyst, sandwiched around 13 years as an economist and financial markets policy analyst at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. He has an MBA and an MA in public policy from the University of Chicago, that is, that Chicago School of Economics, and he writes regularly about financial issues at Boiling Frogs Post. Bill Bergman, welcome to our program today.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Sabelle. Nice to be here.
It's good to talk with you, and you and I are both shareholders in AIG. I'm just reading your latest dispatch to the Boiling Frogs Post. How's our stock doing today, Bill?
Well, it was down a smidgen, but it's been down about 40 or 50% in the last year. It's not doing so well, so we're not doing as well as we might be in standing behind AIG and its position in the financial crisis.
And we're all shareholders because of the government bailout. That's your point.
Yes, and we have a duty to watch our investment if you care about your money.
Well, I have a little artifact here that I've held on to since AIG led the crash in 2008, and it's called Inspiration for Young People of All Ages. It's a little book of poetry published by AIG, and one of them is the Rudyard Kipling poem If, which reads in part, "If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss."
That says a lot about how our financial system has been erected and structured, and what we're paying today for the consequences of moral hazard and all the public guarantees that are behind the banking system.
And let me read from the back here, the AIG blurb. It says, in life, there's no substitute for experience. The same goes for your money. 85 years of helping families and businesses worldwide means you can rely on the AIG companies. Over 50 million customers know that for long-term financial solutions, the AIG companies can help steer you and your family in the right direction. Isn't that comforting, Bill?
In fact, there are a lot of hardworking people trying to right the ship over there. But having said that, what we've been through is a consequence both of AIG as well as a broader set of financial market participants in the last 2 years has been just draconian relative. I mean, it's been as bad as anything since the Great Depression.
Well, and Bill, as someone who's worked for the Federal Reserve Bank in Chicago, I imagine you took special interest in the first phase of the audit of the Fed that was released this summer, and you wrote at least two dispatches for Boiling Frog's Post about that. Summarize for our listeners what the key findings were and just how much of our money the Fed put at risk in bailing out the corporate gamblers whose losses mounted. And, of course, those were private losses that were then socialized, publicly embraced as we bailed out this private company.
Well, it's an interesting and difficult question, Peter, what you're raising. The money that was given to this company wasn't given. It was lent. And in fact, the Federal Reserve amounts have been all paid back. Having said that, whether or not the Federal Reserve received the kind of interest rates that it should have received in light of the crisis, that's a more difficult question. But yes, you and I are paying in indirect ways in terms of the economic consequences of the crisis, and it's still not over yet in terms of our investment in AIG and its common stock. We own 3/4 of the equity in this entity, which looks to have generated a loss around $10 billion for us for just one company in the last year or so. So it's a sad state of affairs, especially given, you know, just stepping back for a moment, the way in which we've guaranteed banks directly or indirectly in the banking system. AIG was not a bank, it was an insurance company, but we effectively stood behind it as well, given its role in the financial system and the losses that it could have posed to the larger banks. Given that set of guarantees and insurance that we've provided, it's very, very ironic that we're getting a lesson in moral hazard from an insurance company where the term was originated. The term moral hazard is something that comes from the insurance world, where once, you know, the insurance world recognizes that if it gives us insurance, we have incentives to take more risk than they otherwise would have. And insurance companies know this, and they price it. But you and I, as citizens, we've provided a great deal of insurance to our financial markets, and the amount of risk-taking that took place on that bed of guarantees, to what extent you and I did a good job of monitoring the risk-taking and pricing it effectively, it looks like we did a pretty bad job.
Now, Bill, if we can simplify this for me, because, you know, I hit the wall in Econ 101, Carl Levin, the senator from Michigan, described it in a pithy way because of the email exchanges that he read between Goldman Sachs traders. And he talked about the shitty deals that Goldman was putting out to its own investors and then betting against those deals and taking out insurance from AIG to cover the spread of the risk between the shitty deal and the expected downside losses. Talk a little bit about that and the extent to which, you know, these people crossed the line from high-risk investments to knowing that they were offering fraudulent investments that were not the highly rated loans that the rating agencies said they were.
Well, as soon as you mention rating agencies, you touch a topic that's kind of warm to my heart. We can talk about that a little bit later. But looking at, you know, the consequences, you'd mentioned that Goldman Sachs had effectively, you know, been transacting with AIG in ways that insulated it from risk, except for one thing. AIG couldn't make good on the promises, on the insurance. That's why you and I were spending money to put money in AIG, so AIG could, in turn, insulate Goldman Sachs and some large European financial institutions, interestingly, from the consequences of their own decisions. And that's not, you know, when people talk about our free markets, we're pretty far from it if large financial participants like AIG, like Goldman Sachs, like the other institutions in Europe can be they don't bear the cost. They take the upside, but we're holding them up on the downside. And whether or not we really have free markets in the United States, I think we're pretty far from it.
Mm-hmm. And so when we look back at the bailout of AIG, that Goldman Sachs was first to get fully repaid the monies that it had owing from AIG, and then the big picture of how much money Bernanke and Hank Paulson put in play to rescue the economy. Nomi Prins, a writer who also used to work for Goldman and one other Wall Street bank, estimated the total outlay in cash and assumption of liabilities at somewhere north of $14 trillion at its peak. Do you estimate in the same range? And at what point was the Fed a rogue agency that was simply bailing out losers in this country and in other parts of the world in ways that nobody had any real oversight or responsibility for?
Well, I guess let's try to be the devil's advocate for the moment and consider the consequences of what if the Federal Reserve hadn't done and the Treasury hadn't done what they did, what would have happened. And the cry is something called systemic risk, where if AIG had failed, it may have caused the failure of larger organizations and, in turn, the failure of other people who were connected to those organizations. And the public policy justification for the amount of money that we did put at risk, which was a lot, the $16 trillion number is one that sounds like it's similar to the GAO audit number that was not adjusted for the term of the lending, for instance. But having said that, it's just simple to note that it was a massive amount of our money that was put in play in order to insulate the big banks from being exposed to the failures of one another, which may have been a good thing in hindsight. I don't think so, but it's possible. You can make an argument that it was. Having said that, you got to step back and think, well, wait a minute, how do we get in this situation in the first place? And that's the more interesting and important set of questions. How did we allow ourselves to get put into a position where we had to do this? And I think that's where you can start looking at the regulators and being a little more critical.
Mm-hmm. And I feel that we should have allowed bankruptcies to go forward. After all, the description of AIG at its lowest was that the company was roughly four-fifths solvent, and that it was the 20% that was at risk and underwater. And I'm kind of a fundamentalist on some of these things, that those people who ran those companies up onto the rocks deserve to sort that out. And bankruptcy is the mechanism we have for that. Yet we were told that that was unthinkable. Do you agree?
I don't agree personally. I know there's an excellent, interesting debate on this score, but no, I agree with you, Peter. I think we should have seen a lot more, well, carnage is the wrong word, but we should have seen losses imposed on the people that took the risks. And I think, you know, our society is strong enough under the there are 250 million people here in the United States, and there's a lot of hardworking people that have a lot of their own resources that can get along without the big banks. And we could have seen more responsible banking in the future. It's possible we laid the seeds for a crisis down the road, in part because of the bailouts, because we left the systems in place that caused us the problem in the first place. So I agree with you. I think we should have seen more bankruptcy, more insolvency resolution as opposed to the bailouts.
Mm-hmm. Sibel, I want to ask you next to tell us the story of how you met Bill Bergman and recruited him to write for the Boiling Frogs Post.
Right. Bill and I, we go way back when, because in 2004, when I started the work and the activities for setting up an organization for national security whistleblowers, because we found out that there are no NGOs, organizations, that brings whistleblowers from these national security-related agencies, government whistleblowers, in one place. And back then, I believed in congressional campaigns, and these were during my, I guess, more naive days. I was still a bit optimistic. But also, this was during the time that I was really fighting nights and days and nights and days on my case, because my case had just gone through the appellate court, and we were getting ready to go to the Supreme Court. So anyway, this was when I was interviewing and investigating the applicants, the national security whistleblowers, who were coming to me and saying, yes, we want to be part of NSWBC. If I remember correctly, Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, because again, this was 7 years ago. Initially, when Bill contacted me and said, you know, just told me a little bit about his case with the Federal Reserve and 9/11, I was kind of quick to say, well, you know, we only deal with whistleblowers who come from national security-related agencies like law enforcement, FBI, CIA. And this was, I call also this period my, you know, that Seinfeld soup Nazi.
Right.
Every day I was getting like 50, 60 phone calls and emails from people from like Department of Education or even some, you know, semi-private schools, whistleblowers who wanted to become a part of NSWBC. And I'm like, just take a look at the name. It's National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. And even among the whistleblowers from these security-related agencies, I had to find out, well, did they blow the whistle on some really important issues, or are they coming now saying they're whistleblowers because they wanted something, the government didn't do it for them, the government agencies? Because I was really picky. That's why I'm giving the analogy of the soup Nazi, because like, no NSWBC for you. You can't come in because you don't fit, because I wanted to make sure that we had this great core group. And so I was hesitant first, and I was so wrong, because once I got to know a little bit about Bill's case and Bill joined the NSWBC, he actually ended up being the most active member. Whether it was during our congressional campaigns, he would be doing so much in terms of writing letters, calling the congressional offices. If we had little conferences, events here, he would come down here from Chicago. He gave so much to NSWBC. In fact, I'd say more than any of other members we have, and we have had really good active members. And then 2 years ago, when I started the Boiling Frogs Post, just as a little personal blog, again, Bill came to rescue in terms of encouraging me to continue, and he was so supportive, and he has been. So for 7 years, Bill has been incredibly supportive in various activities that I have been engaged in, whether on the whistleblowers-related activism or the media-related activism. And not only that, Peter, I don't know if you know about it or not, we have been having these theories on 9/11 and these CIA analyst cases, mm-hmm. and the podcast that was going to be broadcasted by Novosielski.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, Bill is the one, and he's too humble. He's the one who actually helped them to raise some funding and get the funding to do that. So he also played a role with the production of all these issues you and I have been talking about and writing about.
Wow.
And he has been helping some really good causes, and he has been doing so much, and he is just too humble to talk about those stuff. I value him as a friend, as a supporter, and now I'm delighted to have him at Boiling Frogs Post as our financial analyst and an author. And from here, I want to also emphasize the fact that Bill's case, although extremely important, has not received the coverage it truly deserves on his case related to 9/11. And this is one of the issues I really want to have him discuss here during our show, because this is one area in 9/11-related issues that really nobody touches upon, nobody talks about. You know, everybody talks about the CIA and the FBI, and back then the FAA and now TSA, Department of Homeland Security. But nobody talks about the real financial aspects of 9/11 and what went uninvestigated with the 9/11 related financial issues and reports, and I want us to discuss why this area has been so blacked out, both by the media but also by the alternative media and all these various authors that have been writing books after books on 9/11 and 9/11 related analysis. this big chunk missing, and that is the, you know, the financial irregularities and also financial related, really highly suspicious stuff that was not investigated by the 9/11 Commission. It was never addressed really by the Congress, and nobody seems to be writing any books or articles about it.
Well, so, Bill Bergman, first, do you want to revise or extend her remarks about you and how you connected with NSWBC?
I really appreciate her remarks about me, and in fact, just to briefly reiterate, I'm happy to be working with her. I think Sabelle and you are both doing something. You know, our media is in a stage of transformation in a good way, and you guys are contributing to a revival in the importance of the media and our democracy. So, thanks.
Now, let's take a look at the piece that you published at Boiling Frogs Post on the 11th of September this year. You have a graph that very clearly shows a huge spike in the M1 money supply, that's cash in circulation, in the months of July and August of 2001. And you point out that this was the fifth fastest growing month since 1980 or something like that?
It's something kind of like that, yeah. We're talking about actually the currency component of M1. M1 includes two main things, demand deposits, say checking account balances, and currency circulating outside of banks, a smaller number, but still something that's close to $900 billion today, where there's over $900 billion in currency, it looks like, that's circulating outside of banks. And in fact, in August 2001, at the time I was looking at the data when I was working at the Federal Reserve in late 2003 and working in a money laundering position, I noticed that the August was, I ranked all the months since World War II from top to bottom in the growth rate in currency, and saw that the single fastest growing month in those 650 plus months was December 1999. Make some sense?
That was right before Y2K.
Yep.
Yeah.
But there was also the Millennium Terrorism threat was operating at the time. We'll hold that thought for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
The second fastest growing month in those 600 months was January 1991. Any thoughts there? What do you? Anything come to mind when you're?
Well, that was around the time of the invasion of Kuwait.
Well, it was after the invasion of Kuwait, and it was actually the onset of U.S. military action in Iraq at the time. And, in fact, there's some interesting reasons why currency is used in military operations, both overt and covert. In fact, our Congress has been investigating the corruption of currency shipments in Afghanistan in recent years.
Right.
And that's another story. But the other thing that was going on in January 1991, which may be a coincidence, but there was an important enforcement month in the BCCI scandal,
sure.
a huge money laundering scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if one or both of those factors were operating in January 1991. And then the third fastest growing month was August 2001,
mm-hmm.
even after a significant increase in July 2001.
And is there any non-9/11 related explanation for that? Were people, patting their wallets, looking for more walking around money because it was summertime?
Well, the data is seasonally adjusted, so that's a hard nut to crack. At least, the statistics are adjusted for seasonal. But, in fact, there was, and it may be completely innocently explained, even today, by a banking crisis in Argentina, where bank accounts were denominated both in peso as well as dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an important role for the U.S. dollar in Argentina. And certainly there were large shipments of currency to Argentina. Having said that, that doesn't mean that it's the only explanation out there, and there's at least two other very important explanations that are possible that we have no evidence that there's an official investigation of yet.
And those are?
Well, under the money laundering laws and laws in time of war, assets in the banking system can be frozen and seized by the regulators and the law enforcement authorities under laws dating, for instance, to the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917. And in fact, after the during the Iranian hostage negotiations in 1980, and as well as the right after the embassy bombing bombings in Africa in 1998, we went out and froze assets in the banking system of suspicious parties. And given that we have that history, and it's known that that's the kind of thing that happens, if you have the possible explanation for part of the surge in currency shipments, and we're talking about billions of dollars of $100 bills that was above normal in July and August 2001, the possibility arises that the shipments were arising because people were concerned that their assets might be frozen and seized in the banking system, as we did after 9/11, and they took their money out of the United States before 9/11, before that happened. So it seemed to me that tracking that possibility would help us identify anyone with prior knowledge of the events of 9/11, as well as people that might have actually been responsible for those events.
Mm-hmm.
That's one, I think, important possible explanation, that we have no evidence that, for instance, the 9/11 Commission never touched this topic and had some suspect explanations.
One of many topics that they skirted or just completely ignored. And what is your other possible explanation, Bill?
Well, that's a little less probable in my head, but it's still growing on me, and it's related in part to the ways in which my case may intersect with Sabell's. And there's a book out there by Tim Weiner called Legacy of Ashes. It's about the CIA,
mm-hmm.
and it describes how the CIA and other defense and intelligence agencies were arriving in Afghanistan with, quote, bales of $100 bills soon after 9/11.
Right.
With the currency being part of the overt and covert military operations that we've had in Afghanistan since 9/11. And one possibility, given that reportedly we had negotiations over energy issues in Afghanistan that broke down in August 2001, soon before 9/11, with military threats applied during those negotiations, the possibility arises in my head that it's possible that we had covert operations underway in Central Asia in soon before 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And if we were able to investigate this, what tools are needed? Because I don't understand the details of the monetary system and what kind of forensic tools are available to you. But is there a way that you know of that we could look back at July and August of 2001 and see where that cash was going? See who was pulling it out of ATMs or pulling a pallet load out and flying it somewhere.
Well, those tools are available in theory, and the Federal Reserve takes very scrupulous notes about where its money is going, at least at the point of departure. But having said that, there's also another element here that's pretty interesting. The Federal Reserve operates a program called the Extended Custodial Inventory Program, where large institutions, the Federal Reserve contracts with them to monitor and carry the cash that's used out there instead of the Federal Reserve banks. So there's a public-private partnership on this score in terms of data availability. And in fact, in 2004, the Federal Reserve fined UBS, one of those ECI operators, $100 million for not monitoring and not living up to its agreement to monitor those funds in ways that may be related to this case, but that's one aside. The other tool that's out there is, you know, that we have all this data about currency shipments, and it's possible it's been looked at, and they just don't talk about it. But the data is, in theory, out there. The other tool are these currency transaction reports. Banks are required to file if there's any currency transaction above $10,000. They're mm-hmm. required to file these reports. In addition, there's a related report called a suspicious activity report, which is another part of my, in fact, a direct part of my story. I had seen these currency shipments, as well as on August 2, 2001, and this is in late 2003 when I noticed this, I noticed that the Federal Reserve Board of Governors had issued a letter to the Reserve Banks on August 2, 2001. It was a non-routine supervisory letter that was urging the Reserve Banks to scrutinize suspicious activity reports. Those reports are, that letter itself didn't mention terrorism or its financing, but they were known to be part of the realm of suspicious activities. And the question arose in my head whether that letter itself was related to the heightened intelligence warnings that we've learned a great deal more about that were available in July and August. But at the time I asked my questions, there wasn't that much information about it. I just thought I'd heard about intelligence warnings, but I didn't know what I know today. So I think it was a good question whether that letter was related to heightened intelligence of a terrorist threat. And we could look at suspicious activity reports that were filed if those, you know, those are confidential documents, but Congress with subpoena authority could take care of that issue, I think.
Well, and I'm frustrated because these money laundering rules mostly aimed at drug sales and traffickers. Are so frustrating. I mean, I go in and try to deposit a check or $3,000 or $4,000 from one of my accounts to another, and the teller says, hold on, and a supervisor has to come over and initial the check. and they are reviewing these things looking for suspicious activity in very ordinary transactions. And so if I have to live with that level of scrutiny, then it's real frustrating, Bill, to imagine that our government has turned a blind eye to the reports that should have been filed related to suspicious activity prior to 9/11. And as you point out, the commission itself has a false statement in its final report saying that before September 11th, the Treasury Department did not consider terrorist financing important enough to mention in its national strategy for money laundering. And you refute that quite handily, saying that the term terrorist or terror appears 17 times in a 50-page report from the Treasury called the National Money Laundering Strategy, dated 2001.
And the years before that as well. It was known and emphasized as an element of the national money laundering strategy. The question arises, you know, was this just a casual mistake on the part of the 9/11 Commission, or were they trying to tell a story that was false? This is one avenue of investigation. And regarding your observation about, you know, the cost that you and I and everyone else has to pay with our smaller transactions, but if the powers that be are turning a blind eye when it really matters, I suspect Sabell has some experience in that area, that she, you know, in terms of the types of money laundering that she was observing.
Yes, and again, in this case, the FBI was getting the information through the counterintelligence-related operations, which means at the time these investigations were conducted under the FISA rule. This was before the NSA, and everyone started using no whatsoever system in terms of just going willy-nilly and gathering data of all Americans. But what we collected had to do with the foreign organizations, both lobby-related organizations, but also foreign businesses. They were front foreign businesses. And even certain individuals within the diplomatic communities, you know, the embassies and the attachés, etc., together with their U.S. counterparts, who were high-level U.S. people, were using, I'm talking about millions and millions and millions of dollars regularly on a monthly basis through the laundering. And some of these had to do with the narcotics, and these were at least the ones that we dealt with at the FBI. The source was the Eastern, the heroin coming through the Balkans and the Central Asia to Europe, and from Europe to the United States. Again, FBI was fully aware of this through the counterintelligence operations. There was nothing being done, and this information was not, for example, being shared by the ones that involved the drug operations. They were not sharing this information with the DEA, the drug enforcement agencies. And again, I want to emphasize, this was not because the agents who were working the case, they were bad or they didn't want to share. They had strict orders from the executive levels at the Department of Justice not to share this information with the DEA and other relevant agencies, for example, in this case, the Treasury, etc., because they had their own orders from the State Department saying these were some of our covert operations and also involving sensitive diplomatic relations and foreign activities. So there was this chain that actually started with the CIA State Department and then came through the FBI, preventing the real criminal investigations or sharing of these reports and these activities with other agencies. So it involves State Department, CIA, and then the FBI. So narcotics were part of this, but the other part had to do with the candidates, political campaigns, and this was for both the House and the Senate, and it involved both parties. And in the cases that I directly was involved with, again, this is part of this whole state secrets privilege, there was these activities that the money laundering that was taking place, they were all centered in Chicago, every single one of these, whether the narcotics-related operations, with the full knowledge of the FBI, State Department, and the CIA, or the laundering that was taking place for the political campaign, you know, the collected cash or the foreign money would get laundered and then in various ways through various channels would get to certain political candidates, both Republicans and Democrats. And it also involved some offshore accounts. And in this case, it was the banks, again, involved with this were in Cayman Islands. And these banks and Cayman Islands actually was at the time being represented by a very famous ex-congressman who used to be the Speaker of the House. This was before Hastert. So you had a former high-level congressman that now was a lobbyist who also happened to represent Cayman Islands and the banks in Cayman Islands as his lobbying firm, who then worked with these criminal operatives in Chicago to launder millions and millions of dollars and get it to specific candidates. Again, these all networks actually, in some ways, they came together. And I want to emphasize one more time, full knowledge of the FBI, the CIA, and the State Department. And ongoing, at least as far as my knowledge goes, since 1996. These operations were, you know, were ongoing operations that were taking place from 1996 all the way until the time, the date that I left the FBI, which was early 2002, where you're looking at a period of 6 years. And nobody can say, oh, well, you know, sometimes some criminal investigations would take years and years and years. There were no criminal investigations. We had this information at the FBI, in the FBI, because of the counterintelligence operations. And counterintelligence operations were being limited to only listening and obtaining this information and doing nothing, absolutely nothing with it.
And Bill,
and of course, Dennis Hastert, you know, Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at some of these Turkish organizations involved in my case, and their names have been leaked, you know, the front organizations like Turkish American Cultural Alliance, its center in Chicago. The Fethullah Gulen case that Peter and I have been covering here at Boiling Frogs Post, they moved their financial center and the center of their financial operations to Chicago because in Chicago they had everyone. I mean, when I was talking about the Senate and the House, these were some of the operatives and the operations, but the heart and the center of operations involved the heart and the center of Chicago. I mean, you're looking at big names. You're looking at people like Daley. You're looking at people like Congresswoman Tchaikovsky's husband, who actually went to jail, okay? Mr. Robert Bob Creamer. You're looking at really recognizable big names who've been just, you know, they're just operating. They're out there untouched. 1996, right now is 2011. The information is, what, 15 years old, and nothing has happened. Nothing has happened to these people, despite all the records and evidence available in the hands of the FBI, but their hands, FBI's hands, being tied by the State Department and the CIA.
And, Bill, you're there in Chicago. Is there anything you can add to the idea of this as a hub for activity that is known to our government, known to be illegal, and permitted to continue for reasons that are still unknown to us?
Well, I have no direct, except for my own experience, I have no direct knowledge of specific, but I can share one piece of background that's semi-humorous on this score. Chicago, of course, has a long history of awareness of its semi-corrupt governmental structure in the past. It's a city it's called the city that works, and one of the reasons it works is that the things happen behind the scenes that aren't necessarily legal all the time. One of the ironies in my own situation, I found out about 10 years ago that I was named after, well, my grandmother was ashamed of her Irish family background. I never knew why until about 10 years ago when I found out why I was named William, and it turned out I was named after one of Al Capone's biggest enemies in Chicago, from the west side of Chicago, the Irish families out there. And it was a little ironic, I thought, that, you know, here I was losing my job soon after asking some good questions about money laundering to be. Anyway, it's but Chicago, I can't share anything except for some of my direct personal experience that touches on, for instance, the roles of the names that that Sabell mentioned.
Well, and I'll say that I left Chicago in 1976, and so my information is a little stale. But at that time, the FBI and the Chicago police had a very close relationship. The well-known state-sponsored killing of Fred Hampton was done by the Chicago police under the direction of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. And so there's history there. I can't bring it to the present day with any kind of reliability, but it allows the suspicions at any rate to live freely. Let me turn to another aspect of your article at Boiling Frogs Post, Bill Bergman, because many people are aware that there were puts, there were options taken out on the stock of United Airlines and American Airlines. Somebody made a fortune on that, but to our knowledge has never collected the money. You point out that by looking at the stocks of reinsurance companies, you see a pattern of trading in their shares that indicates that people were concerned about potential losses at two big reinsurance companies, Munich Re and the French firm AXA. Talk a little bit about that, Bill.
Okay. Going back to a little bit further, my University of Chicago experience taught me to respect how markets can be efficient and what that means. The ways in which markets our financial markets incorporate information rapidly and price information rapidly, because, you know, for the simple reason that if you're walking down a sidewalk, you don't see too many $100 bills, because if there were there, they'd get picked up, and the same thing happens in the securities markets. So that's why the FBI and the CIA have information systems that look at financial market patterns for possible threats of terrorism activity. And these reinsurance companies are a very interesting group, and insurance companies on this score, given their exposure to the events of 9/11. 9/11 provided, at the time, I think, the largest single loss in Munich Re's history. Munich Re is a reinsurance firm, a long-established one in Germany, one of the largest reinsurance companies in the United States, in the whole world. And these reinsurance companies are very interesting. You and I, we buy insurance. Well, insurance companies themselves don't hold all of their insurance. They're concerned about their own risks, and they purchase insurance themselves from a wholesale market called reinsurance companies. And reinsurance is it's a huge business, big money, and there's a great deal. There's a thriving industry in Bermuda, for instance, that does a great deal of insuring for insurance companies and does so in a very efficient way. But it's just one of the nuts in the whole insider trading, possible informed trading that was happening in the weeks before 9/11. The movement in the securities prices for both Munich Re, AXA, and other insurance companies were pretty amazing. Significant declines in the 2 weeks before 9/11.
And Bill, in broad numbers, to the extent you know this, what was the actual insured liability of the airlines for the four lost planes and passengers on 9/11, and was reinsurance used to make those insurance payments to the beneficiaries?
I don't have the exact numbers at my head. I know they're large, but reinsurance and insurance would have been involved. And in turn, more importantly, you know, the structures in the towers and the surrounding communities were all insured. And that's where the direct, I think, exposure to the insurance company arises.
Well, and it's fairly well and reliably reported that Silberman, who took over the lease on the World Trade Center towers in July of 2001, increased his insurance coverage for catastrophic events. And I believe he had $3 billion each on the Twin Towers. Am I remembering that correctly?
I don't know if the number is exact, but you are, you know, I am aware of that story, and it's possible it's just a coincidence.
Okay. And so when we follow the money related to 9/11, what are the remaining open issues, Bill? First and foremost for me, it's the Saudi money, the 28 pages that remain redacted from the report on Saudi financing The $100,000 that was wired to Mohammad Atta from the head of the ISI, the Pakistani Secret Service, and also the money transfers first from Washington to San Diego. Some of that money was transferred by the wife of Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the United States. There was also, we're getting reporting in the last couple of weeks about a location in Sarasota, Florida, in a gated community where a family apparently was housing a couple of the eventual hijackers. And they hurriedly left the country just 2 days before 9/11. And the description is it looked like they ran out to the grocery store and didn't come back. Their house was left, almost completely intact. Are those issues that you'd like to be able to delve into?
Well, all of them, I think, are relevant and need to be put to rest at a minimum. I think they open the door to thinking about, stepping back for a minute, one of the statements that was a bit shocking in the 9/11 Commission report was on page 172, when the commission, after discussing financial issues and the possible source of funding for Al-Qaeda, said that, at the end of the day, the U.S. government can't identify the source of the funding for the attacks, and it's, in any event, it's of little practical significance, given that Al-Qaeda had many sources of funding. And I suspect that there's more to the story under there. I mean, you following the money is a fundamental aspect of criminal investigations. And washing our hands of looking at where the funding was coming is certainly something that's still open. In turn, I think that, you've raised that issue about the Florida story. Russ Baker recently did a good piece, and mm-hmm. other people have done some work on that score. And I think events are unfolding. It certainly highlights, if they were trying to escape with their bodies prior to 9/11 out of the United States, the other question is whether or not money was moving in that direction as well, trying to get their money out of the U.S. banking system. It seems to raise a plausible question that the incentives are there to, if you're concerned that your assets are at risk of being frozen or seized, you might have an incentive to get out of Dodge and get into the underground economy. And that could have been some of the currency shipments that I saw.
And, Bill, has there been any further discovery of the options related to airline stocks right around 9/11? Because somebody made a small fortune on that, and the last I had heard, the individual or account holder had never claimed the profits.
I haven't seen much updating that story. I haven't seen that story discussed in the mainstream media really at all lately.
I have one question, and that is, we know how, in a way, it's difficult, or they have made it such a difficult hell-like experience for government employees from intel agencies who have secret, top secret clearance to come forward and report on, these cases, suspicious activities, etc. My question is, why don't we have tons of whistleblowers from other agencies that are related, from the Treasury or the banking and the Federal Reserve or even some of these companies on these 9/11 related information that were not investigated, was not investigated at all? How come we haven't had any whistleblowers? Because they don't face the same level of threat, as the intel employees and agents and analysts, et cetera. So what do you think would explain the absence of more whistleblowers, or actually whistleblowers, period, from these industries and these types of agencies on these 9/11 related information?
Well, the incentives may not be equal, but I promise you that the environment is not so easy for the financial people either, and the ways in which independent thinking are suppressed. Peter, we discussed earlier the financial crisis, and I was already in some hot water before I entered my money laundering position for a few things that I'm proud of at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, I developed a proposal in 2003 that was arguing that the Federal Reserve should strip references to credit ratings out of Federal Reserve regulations. And in hindsight, in terms of the financial crisis, the role of credit ratings in being incorporated in mm-hmm. regulations was a central element to the financial meltdown. And in hindsight, I did a good thing, but I promise you it wasn't easy. I just got sneered at, and all the conventional wisdom was against me, and that was one of the lesser ways I was in hot water. I developed a couple other papers and really got in trouble. I mean, there's threats. It's a bureaucracy. So, when I was in that money laundering role, I had to go through an FBI background check. I had to sign a confidentiality agreement with great scope for the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago to define what is or is not confidential information. And there are certainly strong incentives against whistleblowing in both the financial sector and in the intelligence agencies.
Well, and in your case, they couldn't take away a security clearance, but they could threaten you with kicking you out of the bankers' club and making sure you don't have a future at an investment bank, right?
Well, that may be putting it overly, but yes, that's kind of what happened to me. In fact, it was a week after I asked the question. I was developing a primer on money laundering, and this 40-question Q&A, I was told it could serve as a reference document for the examiners. Why don't I go ahead and answer the only question that I hadn't answered? And the only question that I hadn't answered was whether or not that August 2nd, 2001 letter was related to any heightened intelligence of a terrorist threat. And I was told to go ahead and answer the question, so I called the board staff and I asked. And I was ready to, I went into the phone call with a good attitude. I thought I'd figure some things out with respect to these currency shipments and why that was possibly something we needed to get on board, and because I hadn't seen any evidence that it had been investigated already. And a week after I asked the question, the phone call was a little briefer than I anticipated, and my security, quote unquote, my access to confidential information was yanked, and my assignment in that money laundering role was terminated, and I was told I had committed an egregious breach of protocol asking the question, even though I had been asked to answer it. And a month later, my position at the bank was eliminated.
Wow. And what is the status of that, Bill? Have you sued to get your job back?
No, I haven't. I was, my dad said don't do stuff like that, and I never really, and some advice from some good people, the whistleblowing laws are so poor that, you just don't have really stand a chance. I just try to do my job, and I hope, the truth comes out someday.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill, in closing, I'd like to ask you to comment. We're speaking here toward the end of September. And for the last 12 or 13 days, a growing group of protesters has been gathering and camping out on Wall Street. And first there was a media blackout, but thanks to Michael Moore and unfortunately to overreaction by members of the NYPD, the story is starting to get out. People are learning about this. And the hope of some of the organizers is that protests will pop up all over the country. And the focus is on the economic system. The protesters claim that they speak for the 99%, not the ultra-wealthy who have gained in wealth and power in exponential terms in the last 10 or 20 years. And I'd like to know your thoughts about this protest and if it can produce any meaningful change.
Well, I took a walk down LaSalle Street the other day to take a peek at what was going on outside of the Chicago Fed, and the signs were things like tax the rich and jobs, not profits, and to what extent it was maybe more of a party. I would have preferred a little more strenuous scrutiny of the. I come from a little bit of a Ron Paul perspective myself, and a little more scrutiny of the actual role of the Fed in the crisis as opposed to some more broader political ambitions on the part of potentially, this is, they say they speak for 99%, and certainly there's a large majority out there that's been effectively disenfranchised through our financial system. But I think as taxpayers, we have broader issues about looking at the quality of our financial regulation and how we got here in the first place, not just the jobs, not profit, but Peter, you and I both share Chicago, I guess, in our background. And
mm-hmm.
I went to the University of Chicago, and some of my favorite courses were in that economics department, and I still have I wave that flag, and sometimes.
I understand. Just one more thing. In the Republican presidential debates, the Dodd-Frank legislation is demonized as a job killer and as unnecessary regulation. And, Bill, I regard it as a very tepid step toward what we really needed, which was something equivalent to the Glass-Steagall Act to prevent consumer banks from risking depositors' money in extremely risky schemes and investments. And yet we're hearing this pushback as if we had very serious re-regulation of the banking and investment systems in our country. What is your take, and when you hear these people talk about repealing Dodd-Frank, how do you respond?
in a narrow sense, I'll just immediately address one interesting element of Dodd-Frank that relates to my experience, and that's the Dodd-Frank provision that directs the Federal Reserve and other regulators to strip references to credit ratings out of their regulations. They're not allowed to do that, or they're not asked to do that right away, but they have to develop their own systems for monitoring credit risk and not outsource their own responsibilities to the credit rating agencies. That was a central element why our banking system was undercapitalized going into the crisis. But stepping back just for a minute, I mean, when I think about regulation, there are two ways in which we regulate, quote-unquote, our financial system. We guarantee a lot of their liabilities. We enter the system because we're capital providers by guaranteeing those entities. And as soon as, you know, the recognized incentives are, wait a minute, we have to regulate them if we're going to guarantee their behavior. And as a consequence, Dodd-Frank does go a little bit further along the lines of more regulation. But why is that regulation required in the first place? Perhaps we should go to the beginning of the system and take away the guarantees and allow the free market to operate in our financial markets. That's my personal policy bent.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Well, then let me ask you one more thing, because I really support Ron Paul in the initiative that he and Barney Frank and a handful of others pushed through to force this partial audit of the Fed. At the same time, Ron Paul talks about government regulation as a generally evil thing, and even was kind of gotcha'd into a trick question about letting a 20-something kid die because he didn't have health insurance. So how, in your, you know, support for Ron Paul, how do you balance his anti-regulatory stance with, again, what I consider to be a very healthy position about the Federal Reserve?
Well, I don't, you know, I'm not a full-fledged Ron Paul supporter, but I do appreciate the perspective that he's bringing, and in fact, he's one of my favorite candidates out there now. But stepping back for a minute, how do you rationalize these seemingly disparate positions? Well, in fact, he's written a book called End the Fed. He wouldn't just audit the Fed. His goal is to end the Federal Reserve and end central banking. And that's, you know, I think that's more consistent with what you're, you know, the kind of outlook that you're identifying.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Bill, it's a real pleasure to talk with you. Thanks again for joining us today, and thanks for your contributions to Boiling Frogs Post.
Well, nice to talk to both of you, and it's nice to hear your voice again after 30 years here, Peter. We miss you in Chicago.
All right. Bill Bergman here on the Boiling Frogs interview series.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.